A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's got a whole thing this week about the moment a surveyor's line meets a shepherd's path. He says we've covered the history of borders before, but he wants the friction point. The Bedouin on both sides of the Israel-Egypt line, Druze communities split across the Israel-Syria divide. People who regard the very concept of a state border as a foreign import. And his actual question is how authorities grappled with them, back when borders were first being precisely defined and guarded. Israel, he thinks, is the sharpest case. Because for a while, when security allowed, informal crossing was tolerated. Not out of sentiment, out of a calculation that policing harmless movement would damage a way of life without improving national security. And then he wants the global sweep. Other places where the new idea of a precise line ran into people who never had a hard concept of state.
The thing that most coverage gets wrong is treating this as a morality play. Oppressive state versus innocent nomad. It's not that. It's two incompatible systems of territoriality colliding, and the state usually wins because it has surveyors and fences and a budget.
The surveyor's line is the anomaly. For most of human history, a border was a river or a ridge or a watershed, something you could point at without a map. The centimetric line, the one marked with brass discs and coordinates, is maybe 150 years old in most places.
And the Bedouin and the Druze aren't stateless in any meaningful sense. They have their own systems. Kinship, grazing rights, seasonal migration routes, tribal law. They just don't recognize the state's claim to draw a line through the middle of that.
So the question is, what happens at the moment of contact? The surveyor plants a marker, and a man who's crossed that exact spot every spring for 40 years asks which side his house is on.
Let's start with the mechanism. Before the 20th century, most borders were natural features. A river is easy to identify and hard to dispute. You don't need a map to know which side of the Jordan you're on. But rivers move. They flood. They change course. So even natural borders had a fuzziness to them. The shift to surveyed, demarcated lines happened because states started to care about exact jurisdiction. Tax collection, military control, legal authority. The line had to be precise because the state's claim had to be precise.
And the Middle East got the sharp end of that transition. The Ottoman Empire didn't think in straight lines. It thought in zones of control, tribal allegiances, tax farms. Then the Mandate era arrived and European powers sat down with rulers and drew lines across maps. The 1906 Egypt-Ottoman border agreement drew a line from Rafa to Taba, straight through Bedouin grazing lands that had been used seasonally for centuries.
1906. That's the key date for the Negev Sinai Bedouin. The line was drawn to settle a dispute between the Ottoman Empire and British-controlled Egypt. The Bedouin weren't consulted. They probably didn't know it existed until someone told them they needed a permit to cross it.
And the line didn't just inconvenience them. It criminalized their economy. Bedouin pastoralism depends on movement. The flocks move with the rain. A tribe's territory might span 100 kilometers of desert, and suddenly an international border runs through the middle of it. The border didn't just divide the territory, it made the traditional use of that territory illegal.
This is the mechanism of friction. A settled agriculturalist can live their whole life on one side of a line. A nomadic pastoralist can't. Their entire social and economic system is built on crossing what became international borders. The state says this line is absolute. The Bedouin says this line doesn't exist. Both are right in their own frame.
So Israel inherits this mess. After 48, and especially after 67, the state controls borders that cut through Bedouin tribal territories in the Negev and Druze communities in the Golan. And the state has to decide. Enforce the line absolutely, or accommodate movement.
The Druze case is slightly different from the Bedouin. The Golan Druze were mostly settled agriculturalists, not nomads, but the 1967 ceasefire line split them from family in Syria. Villages on one side, relatives on the other. The line ran through a lib social network.
The Bedouin case is the sharper one, because the movement is the economy. The Negev Sinai Bedouin had tribes that spanned the line, the Tarabin, the Azazme. Grazing lands on both sides, family on both sides, marriage markets on both sides. The border was an inconvenience that became a crime.
And Israel's response was, for a long time, pragmatic. When security permitted, informal crossing was tolerated, not legalized, just not policed aggressively. The logic was exactly what Daniel described. These are harmless people crossing to visit family or graze flocks. Policing that would be expensive, would damage a traditional way of life, and wouldn't improve national security, so the state looked the other way.
I want to be precise about what that wasn't. It wasn't humanitarianism. It was a cost-benefit calculation. The security services had limited resources. Smuggling and infiltration were real threats. Spending those resources chasing a Bedouin shepherd moving his goats across the line was a bad trade. The tolerance was a byproduct of priorities, not a policy of kindness.
And that's the part most coverage misses. People want to read it as Israel being enlightened or generous. It was neither. It was a rational actor deciding that enforcement wasn't worth the cost. The moment the cost calculation changed, the tolerance ended.
Which is exactly what happened with the Egypt-Israel barrier. Built through the 2000s and 2010s, primarily for security. Smuggling, infiltration, the flow of people from Africa through the Sinai. The barrier went up, and the informal crossing regime collapsed.
The barrier is a fascinating case because it wasn't built to stop Bedouin shepherds. It was built to stop smuggling networks and irregular migration. But a fence doesn't discriminate. The Bedouin who had crossed freely for generations were severed from their grazing lands and family networks just as completely as the smugglers were.
And the Sinai Bedouin had already been through a rough patch. The Egyptian state never really controlled the Sinai the way it controlled the Nile Valley. Bedouin tribes had de facto autonomy for decades. Then the barrier went up, and suddenly the line that had been theoretical became physical.
Concrete and steel and sensors. The centimetric line made visible, and the Bedouin on both sides had to adapt. Some got permits, some moved, some just stopped crossing. The way of life didn't die overnight, but it took a structural hit.
Let's zoom out. Israel is a sharp case, but it's not unique. The same collision happened wherever European powers drew lines through nomadic territories.
The Berlin Conference of 1884 to 85 is the your example. European powers sat in Berlin and partitioned Africa. The principle was effective occupation. You had to actually control the territory you claimed. But the lines they drew ignored tribal territories entirely. Maasai lands split between British East Africa and German East Africa. Somali territories divided among four different colonial powers. Tuareg lands carved up across the Sahel.
The Maasai case is particularly brutal because their entire economy was seasonal migration. The Anglo-German agreements of 1886 and 1890 split Maasai lands between Kenya and Tanganyika. The migration routes that had sustained them for centuries now crossed an international border, and the border was enforced by colonial administrators who had no interest in Maasai territorial logic.
The Maasai didn't have a word for the border. They had a word for the grazing route, the water source, the seasonal pasture. The colonial line cut through all of that, and the colonial state didn't just draw the line. It enforced it with passes, permits, and patrols. The line became a wall, and the wall became a slow catastrophe.
The Kurdish case is the same pattern at a larger scale. After the First World War, the Treaty of Sèvres in 1920 promised the Kurds a state. The Treaty of Lausanne in 1923 took it away. Kurdistan was partitioned among Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. Four hostile borders drawn through a largely nomadic and semi-nomadic population.
The Kurds are interesting because they're not purely nomadic. They've settled agricultural communities too. But the border split them just as thoroughly. Family networks, trade routes, grazing lands, all divided by lines drawn in European capitals by men who had never seen the terrain.
And the Kurds are the case that shows the knock-on effect most clearly. When the state decides to enforce the line starts to do work. It divides families. It disrupts economies. It forces people to choose between citizenship and kinship. The border doesn't just divide territory. It divides people.
The knock-on effect are where the real damage lives. The border itself is just a line, but enforcing it requires documentation. Passports, identity cards, permits. Nomadic people often don't have these things. They don't need them. Their identity is tribal, not national. So the border doesn't just block movement. It creates a new category of person. The person who was always there, but now doesn't belong.
And then there's the fencing. The patrols. The military infrastructure. The border becomes a physical barrier, not just a legal one. And the barrier does something the line on a map never could. It physically prevents movement. It severs the grazing route, the migration path, the family visit. The line on the map was an abstraction. The fence is concrete.
There's a paradox here that I keep turning over. As borders become more precisely defined, they become more heavily guarded. The precision and the enforcement go together. A fuzzy border is hard to police. A precise border invites policing. So the very precision that makes a border modern is what makes it incompatible with nomadic existence.
The modern border is a machine for producing friction. It takes a way of life built on movement and turns that movement into a crime. The Bedouin shepherd crossing the line isn't migrating. He's smuggling. The Maasai herder moving his cattle isn't following the reins. He's violating a border. The state redefines the activity as illegal and then enforces the redefinition.
The Israeli tolerance model was an acknowledgement that full enforcement would be counterproductive. Other states have made similar calculations. Special crossing permits for nomadic communities, seasonal migration agreements, informal tolerance zones. But these are exceptions. The default trajectory is toward harder borders and more friction.
Because the logic of the state points that way. A state that can't control its borders is a failed state, so states invest in control. Fences, sensors, patrols, documentation. And every investment makes the border harder to cross, which makes the friction worse. It's a ratchet.
The Bedouin case in the Negev Sinai shows the ratchet in action. For decades, informal tolerance. Then security concerns shifted, the barrier went up, and the tolerance ended. Not because anyone decided the Bedouin were a threat. Because the technology made enforcement possible, and the security environment made it desirable.
And the Bedouin adapted because people always adapt. Some got permits. Some moved permanently to one side. Some found work in the new economy of the border itself. Smuggling, ironically, became more profitable when the border became harder to cross. The fence didn't end smuggling. It professionalized it.
That's the dark irony. The barrier was built to stop smuggling, and it made smuggling more lucrative. The risk went up, so the prices went up. The Bedouin who had crossed freely for generations now had a new economic opportunity. Smuggling.
The border creates the crime it claims to prevent. Before the fence, a Bedouin crossing the line was just a Bedouin. After the fence, he's a potential smuggler. The line doesn't just divide territory. It creates the categories of legal and illegal, and then sorts people into them.
Let me pull on the Druze thread for a moment because it's a different kind of friction. The Golan Druze weren't nomads, they were farmers. But the 1967 line split them from family in Syria. And Israel's response was, in some ways, more structured than the Bedouin case. There was a program for Druze students from the Golan to study in Syria, crossing at Kenitra. Apples were shipped across the line. Family visits were arranged through the Red Cross.
The apple shipments are a great detail. Golan Druze farmers produce apples. Syria wouldn't buy them, so they shipped them across the line to the Syrian side. The border became a conduit for a specific economic relationship, even as it was a barrier for everything else.
And the crossings were heavily controlled. Buses with tinted windows, strict schedules, no communication between the sides. The state allowed the movement because it served a purpose, keeping the Druze population from becoming completely alienated. But it was managed movement, not free movement. The state was always in control.
That's the difference between tolerance and accommodation. Tolerance is looking the other way. Accommodation is building a system. Israel tolerated the Bedouin crossing and accommodated the Druze crossing. Different communities, different logics.
The Bedouin were seen as a security risk that wasn't worth policing. The Druze were seen as a political asset that needed to be managed, so the Bedouin got informal tolerance and the Druze got formal arrangements. Both were pragmatic calculations. Neither was about respecting traditional lifeways.
The global pattern is the same. States tolerate or accommodate when it serves their interests, and enforce when it doesn't. The Maasai got some accommodation under colonial rule, because the colonial economy needed their cattle. The Tuareg got almost none, because the colonial powers saw them as ungovernable, The Kurds got nothing because every state that inherited a piece of Kurdistan saw Kurdish mobility as a threat.
The Kurds are the case where the border became a weapon. Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran all used the border to fragment Kurdish resistance. A Kurd in Turkey couldn't easily coordinate with a Kurd in Iraq. The border did the work of four armies. And the Kurdish response was to develop a political identity that transcended the border. Kurdish nationalism was, in part, a reaction to being divided.
The border creates the identity it claims to merely describe. Before the line, a Bedouin was a member of a tribe. After the line, he's a cross-border person, a problem, a category. The line doesn't just divide territory. It creates new kinds of people.
And the new kinds of people are often worse off. The cross-border Bedouin has to navigate two legal systems, two sets of documentation requirements, two states that each claim him but neither fully accepts him. He's not Egyptian, not Israeli. He's a border person. The border is his identity.
Which brings us to the modern paradox. The world has more borders than ever, and they're more precise than ever. Satellite imagery, GPS, digital mapping. The line is now knowable to the centimeter, even in places where no one has ever surveyed it. And at the same time, the world has more mobile people than ever. Refugees, migrants, pastoralists, traders. The precision of the border and the mobility of the population are on a collision course.
Climate change makes it worse. Pastoralists move because the rains move. If the rains become less predictable, the movement becomes more urgent, and the borders are still there. Fixed, precise, guarded. The nomad has to move. The state says he can't. The friction intensifies.
The question Daniel asked about how authorities grappled with these communities has a clear answer. They grappled pragmatically, inconsistently, and ultimately destructively. The tolerance was real, but it was always contingent. The moment the calculation changed, the tolerance ended. The border won.
1987. I was doing survey work in the Sinai, civilian contractor for a mapping agency. 3 months near Rafah, resurveying the line after the peace treaty, we'd plant these brass markers, little discs with coordinates stamped on them. One day, an old Bedouin man walked up and watched us for a while. Through a translator, he asked which side of the line his house was on. He didn't know. The line had never mattered before. We checked the coordinates. His house was on the Egyptian side. His well was on the Israeli side. He nodded and walked away. Didn't seem upset. Just noted it.
That's the moment in a single frame. The line runs through a man's house and he finds out from a surveyor.
The agency had a policy. We weren't supposed to tell local communities what the line meant. Just plant the markers and move on. I thought about that a lot afterward. We were drawing a line through people's lives, and we weren't even allowed to explain it to them.
The violence of the border wasn't intentional. It was bureaucratic.
I kept one of the markers. Small brass disc. Coordinates stamped on it. It's in a drawer in my flat. Every now and then I take it out and look at it. A line on a map is just a line, until someone decides to enforce it.
The marker is the perfect object. It's the thing that turns an abstraction into a physical fact. Before the marker, the line is a treaty clause. After the marker, it's a thing in the ground that you can stub your toe on.
And the man's house and well-being on different sides. That's the whole story. The line didn't just divide his property. It divided his water from his shelter. The two things a person needs most on opposite sides of an international border.
We didn't ask him if he wanted us to move the line. We couldn't have. The coordinates were fixed. Our job was to plant the marker where the map said. The map was the reality. The man's house was the anomaly.
That inversion is the heart of it. The map becomes the truth, and the lived reality becomes the error. The surveyor doesn't check the map against the terrain. He checks the terrain against the map.
Then the enforcement follows the markers. Once the brass disc is in the ground, the fence comes. The patrols come. The permits come. The marker is the seed the fence grows from.
The marker I kept is from a line that's now got a fence on it. The Egypt-Israel barrier. I watched them build it. Well, watch the news. Same thing. The line we planted in 87 became a wall. And the old man's house, if it's still there, is behind a fence now.
The barrier sealed the line. The informal crossing that had been tolerated for decades ended. The Bedouin who had moved across that line for generations were cut off, and it started with surveyors planting markers and not explaining what they meant.
The precision was the first act of enforcement. Before the marker, the line was fuzzy. The Bedouin could cross it without knowing it existed. After the marker, the line was exact. And exact lines demand exact enforcement.
I'm not saying the surveyors were villains, we were just doing a job, following coordinates. But the job had consequences we weren't paid to think about. The agency's policy of not telling locals what the line meant. That was the whole problem in one sentence. We weren't supposed to think about what we were doing.
The bureaucratic violence. The line is drawn by people who don't know the terrain, enforced by people who don't know the communities, and the communities are supposed to adapt. The surveyor plants the marker and moves on. The state builds the fence and moves on. The Bedouin is left to figure out which side of the line his life is on.
The answer is usually both, or neither. The border person doesn't fit neatly on either side. He's a straddler, a crosser, a problem for the neat categories the state wants to impose.
The old man didn't ask us to change anything. He just wanted to know. Which side? As if the answer would tell him something he needed to know. Maybe it did. Maybe he moved his bed to the Israeli side and kept his well on the Egyptian side. I don't know. I never saw him again.
The question of which side your house is on only matters if the side has consequences. Before the line was enforced, it didn't matter. The house was just a house. The well was just a well. The line made them into legal facts.
The legal facts are what the state acts on. The man's house is in Egypt. His well is in Israel. So he needs a permit to cross the line to get water. The line turned a daily act into a legal transaction.
I think about him every time I see the barrier on the news. The line we planted became a wall. And the man who asked which side his house was on. He was the first person I ever saw confront the border as a fact of life. A thing that runs through your house and your well.
The border as a fact of life. That's the transition Daniel was asking about, from the border as an abstraction to the border as a physical constraint, and the surveyor is the agent of that transition, the person who makes the abstraction physical.
The misconception most people have is that borders have always been precise, surveyed lines. The reality is that precision is recent, and it was imposed on people who had no concept of it. The Bedouin didn't have a word for the international border. They had a word for the grazing route. The line was a foreign imposition, and the surveyor was its first ambassador.
The second misconception is that nomadic communities are stateless or anarchic. They have their own systems of territoriality, kinship, and law. They just don't recognize the state's claim to draw lines through their lands. The Bedouin have a sophisticated system of tribal territories and grazing rights. It's just not legible to the state.
The third misconception is that Israel's tolerance of Bedouin crossing was humanitarian. It wasn't. It was a pragmatic security calculation. Policing a harmless movement was expensive and counterproductive. The tolerance was a byproduct of priorities, not a policy of kindness. When the priorities changed, the tolerance ended.
The open question this leaves me with is whether we're witnessing the final chapter of a way of life that predates the state by millennia. The precise border is spreading. Climate change is making movement more urgent. The friction is intensifying. Are the remaining nomadic peoples of the world adapting, or are they being slowly eliminated?
If the border is a historical anomaly, what does its continued spread mean for everyone else? The Bedouin are the canary. The rest of us are just living on the other side of the line, waiting for the line to move.
This has been my Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running and for the brass disc in the drawer.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review. It helps other listeners find the show.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.